This is Jill Nadeau with The Larry Mueller Show. We're going to go right to our scheduled guest, and that is our regular PJ Leash. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology. And he's going to talk about spiders with us today. What do you do when you see a spider? Do you scream, dance around, ask someone to kill it? Well, maybe, you know, that's not a really good idea, and PJ's going to tell us why. We're also going to talk a little bit about ticks, and we are going to take your questions. So if you have a questions about insects, something is bugging you, you need an ID, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. PJ, are you with us?
I am, yes.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much for being on just notice for us to go whenever we can. So we appreciate that.
Sure.
So what is it about spiders that freaks people out?
Well, you know, I think it's the fact that they tend to scurry quite a bit.
they do.
Yeah, I mean, and that I feel is just one of their defenses. We have in Wisconsin, the Great Lakes region, about 500 or so species of spiders, and worldwide there's about 40,000 or so.
Oh, amazing.
And what folks don't necessarily realize is that the vast majority of these are really harmless, beneficial creatures. I mean, think about it. If we stood next to a giant, I'd probably be terrified and try to run away as well. So that's often one of their defenses, is if a spider detects your presence, they want to scurry away as quickly as they can to try and hide out somewhere.
Right. Now, they're really part of our ecological system, right? I mean, tell us why they're important.
Well, the vast majority of spiders are predators. There's a very thin slice of the pie. There's a few weird kind of exceptions, certain spiders that will actually feed on plants. But the overwhelming majority of spiders, pretty much all of them, are predators. And they tend to feed on things such as insects. So if you have spiders in your yard or in your house, they're really helping you out, providing free insect pest control. There was a study that came out a couple of years ago that actually tried to quantify this, and it was a mind-boggling number. That study found that they estimated spiders eat around the globe on an annual basis between 400 and 800 million metric tons of insect prey, which is just an astronomical amount. So the paper mentioned that they basically eat pound for pound, you know, as much as the human race does in terms of meat each year. They even eat more than that. So really, they're eating an awful lot of insects and helping us out in that regard.
And that is amazing, really, and you think about it. And when they're in the house, they are also eating bugs and things that we don't necessarily want in there, right?
They are, yeah. I mean, when you have spiders together, if you were to catch a bunch of different spiders and put them in a container, for example, they're probably going to cannibalize each other. But if you look in your house, and most homes have some spiders, but if you see that you have lots of spiders, that tells me there's probably a lot of insects around that they're feeding on as well.
Well, that makes total sense. And we don't see them very often, do we? They like to hide.
Yeah, and it really depends on the type of spiders, because there's dozens of different spider families. Some spiders go with the strategy of building a web and sitting in the web or nearby the web waiting for prey to come to them. Other ones are more active hunters, and some of those may be active during the day, or they may blend in very well. Other ones may be active more at night. But in general, they like to hide away, or they're active at times of the day that we don't necessarily bump into them very easily.
Sure. Now, if you don't, you just can't handle those spiders in your house, what's the best way to get them out? You know, you don't want to kill them, but what's the best way to just get them outside? And if you do take them outside, are they going to survive?
I'd say it depends on the time of the year in terms of survival. If you take a spider from your basement that's maybe in the 60s and you put it outside and it's 10 degrees outside, you know, that's almost certainly going to be lethal to the spider. This time of the year, during spring and summer months, if you find one indoors and put it outdoors, you know, it's probably going to survive out there. It's interesting because we actually have, of our 500 or so species in the state, there's really only a small group of spiders spiders that can survive well indoors. The vast majority of them, if they snuck in from outdoors, it's generally going to be too dry for them. Now, in terms of things you can do about it, again, I mentioned if you've got a lot of spiders in your house, that suggests to me you probably have a lot of insects around as well. And when I think of having lots of insects, that makes me think of insects sneaking in from outdoors. So when I look at the big picture, if you've got a lot of spiders, I would maybe look at your house and do a very close examination, especially on the outside of the structure, like along the foundation, and look and see, are there cracks and crevices that insects and perhaps spiders could be sneaking in through? And if you do find locations like that, perhaps you could seal it up with caulk or expanding insulation foam. In the pest control industry, we'd refer to that as physical exclusion. If you have a structure that is nice and sealed up and tightened up and insect prey is not sneaking in, well, then the spiders just wouldn't have much of a food source and you're not going to have very many spiders as a result.
That's right. And you're going to put your heating bills down a little bit too if you
do that.
Okay, well, we've got some calls, and if you're interested in you have a question for PJ, give us a call, 800-642-1234. We've got Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I'm wondering if spiders need a source of water to drink, and then I woke up in the morning and I was about to turn the light on, and I saw a spider come down from my medicine cabinet down to my sink, and was really amazed when I turned the light on and how he came back up. But I have a problem with fruit flies, and I noticed those fruit flies disappeared very quickly.
Right, very true. What do you think? What about that, PJ? Do they need water?
Well, I mean, all living creatures need water to a certain extent, but do they need to drink it? Not necessarily. If you think of spiders feeding on insect prey, if the insects have moisture within their body, they're going to be able to kind of take that up as well. And I mentioned this a minute ago, but out of our 500 or so species of spiders in the state, there's really a pretty small group that are adapted to the dry conditions indoors. I mean, think of indoors during the winter months. Humidity is pretty darn low. So the spiders that can withstand those conditions, they have special adaptations so that they can maintain moisture within their body, and they may be getting it from sources such as insect prey. There are some other spiders. For example, I have a couple of tarantulas in my office here on campus, and I do put, for example, a large moistened sponge in there that they can use that to get a little bit of moisture if they need it. But I feel a lot of insects probably are getting their moisture needs met by their diet.
Ah, great. Well, thanks for that call, Kenneth. You're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking with PJ Lee. She's the manager of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. What insect questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, we're talking about spiders with PJ Leash today. And if you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll go right back to the phones. We've got Russ in Stoughton who has a question. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. I'm 73 years old, and as far back as I can remember, with my parents renting cabins up in the Wisconsin North Woods by the Turtle Flambeau Flowage, we had what was commonly called or known daddy long leg spiders, and they were everywhere on the screens and this and that. Well, as I got older, I read an article somewhere that daddy long leg spiders actually were venomous or had poison, but actually had no way to deliver it because they had no biting ability. And I always wondered what good would it be do to be poisonous and yet not be able to protect yourself if the information I read is correct.
Okay. What do you say, PJ?
Yeah, so that brings up a really good point. And we do have creatures called daddy long legs, or sometimes they're called harvest men. The thing is, if you took a very close look at those, It looks like they only have one body region where all the legs are attached. It turns out daddy long legs are not true spiders. They're closely related to spiders, and spiders have venom. They are predators and attack insects and things like that. Daddy long legs tend to scavenge on dead or dying insects, and so they really don't need a potent tool to kill their prey because they're tending to feed on things that are kind of dead or dying anyways. I think of them more as scavengers. So for the daddy long legs, or as I said, sometimes we call them harvestmen, they're technically not true spiders, and that notion about their venom, that's essentially an urban myth. I will say, though, there is a true spider that sometimes folks confuse with daddy long legs, and this is a group we'd call our cellar spiders. And these are the ones that most folks have out in their garage. You look in the upper corner of your garage or in your basement, and they build these messy webs up in the corners. And those do have a narrow body with very, very long legs. But if you took a close look at those, we can tell they're true spiders because they have two body regions on them. So again, with those daddy long legs, the notion that they're highly venomous and dangerous to humans, but they can't pierce their skin, that's just an urban myth. They're really pretty harmless creatures.
Okay, thanks for the question, Russ. There are a lot of urban myths about spiders, aren't there?
There are, yeah. It's surprising, and I think part of it is that very few folks take the time to really read up about them and learn about them, and they're really quite fascinating once you do that. I will admit, as an entomologist, growing up, I was never particularly keen on spiders. Over the years, once I've learned about them and learned that they're harmless and really beneficial creatures, the last 5-6 years or so, I've really come to appreciate them and can find them quite beautiful in certain situations.
Okay, great. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Lynn in Rhinelander who has a question. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to give spiders a little bit of a rooting here. I live in a 100-year-old house with a boulder basement. You just can't feel those houses. No, that's all I see a spider. And I don't see any insects, so I know they're doing a really good job. And if they're somewhere where I don't want them, I just put them in the jar and move them somewhere, like onto a plant or something like that. But, I mean, I think this fear of spiders is kind of overblown.
Okay, thanks, Lynn. I'm sure you've seen a lot of that, PJ.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially if you're in an older house, I mean, you just tend to have spiders around. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. There are some colleagues down in North Carolina that basically did a survey of insects and spiders and other creatures found in houses around the country and really found that, you know, having spiders can be a fairly common thing. The vast majority of these are harmless. Certain parts of the country, folks may bump into things like brown recluse spiders inside, although there's even a lot of myths and misunderstandings about that particular species. So again, the spiders that we have in Wisconsin indoors, they tend to be harmless and very, very beneficial creatures.
All right. Thanks for that call, Lynn. Appreciate it. Now, speaking of brown recluse, I believe Matthew in Mozamini has a question about that. Go ahead, Matthew.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a family doctor.
Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
And I find that people are fascinated by the idea that they've been bitten by a spider. They'll come in to see a physician. I think a lot of physicians are unclear about whether there are even brown recluse spiders in Wisconsin. And I see some maps that say they're just absolutely not here. And I wonder what the latest is on that.
Yeah, so you're right that when you look at those range maps, Wisconsin is outside of the range, native range of brown recluse spiders. Have they been picked up in the state from time to time? Yes, but these are very, very rare occurrences. Perhaps a situation where someone has moved up here from a location like Missouri, for example, or Arkansas. If you go to the south of us, then you bump into that native range of that spider. So if you live in places like Missouri, parts of Oklahoma, Arkansas, places like that, they can actually be fairly common, although it's interesting because in its native range, that spider doesn't really seem to cause many, if any, problems. There's been documented cases where families can have literally thousands of brown recluse spiders in their house. no one's ever bitten by them. So again, there's a lot of urban myths, but to get back to your question, up here in Wisconsin, we're well outside the native range of brown recluse spiders, so they tend to be exceedingly rare. My impression is that the vast majority of Wisconsinites will go through their entire lives without ever seeing a brown recluse spider.
Well, great. Thank you for that call, Matthew. If you have a question about spiders or insects, we can handle all of them. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We've got Denise, in Deerfield next. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I was calling to inquire. I live in Deerfield. You wanted to know where everyone is from. I have an inundation of a bug I've never seen in my life before, and a little brown spider managed to grab one in its web, and I thought, good for you. You've gotten one of these things. And I went to the library and looked it up on the Internet. I cannot find a bug like this thing. It's about if you put two pinheads together, the body length on what appears to be the adult would be about that long. And so they're very small, and to look at them, they appear to be black, and they're smaller than that one, too, because they have babies. I saw one come up under the quarter round of the baseboard in my first floor bathroom, and I thought nothing of it. And then the following day, he must have been the scout and brought all his friends along, because I was suddenly inundated with these things, and it was massive. They were all over the place. And then they made their way up through the wall up to the second floor bathroom, and I found them up there as well. Well, this went on for perhaps 24 hours, and then they more or less disappeared because I was smashing everyone I saw and flushing them down the toilet. And I could not find a bug like that. All I can tell you is they are hard like a beetle, and I looked at the so-called adult-sized one under a magnifying glass, and it looked like a medium sort of cafe au lait color with a little bit of black on it and a possibly black head. And it looks like it has clear glass legs. In other words, they're not a solid color. They're not really visible. And they don't appear to be able to fly. And that's all I know. And I've never seen a bug like this in my life before.
Okay. Thank you, Denise. PJ, any idea what that could be?
Well, so it sounded like they were pretty small,
and
they did sound like they were kind of hard and crunchy and beetle-like. So my suspicion, just from the description, of course, is that it's some type of beetle. The thing is, I can think of an awful lot of beetle species that can occur indoors. One group in particular that comes to mind, there's a family Dermestidae that we commonly call our carpet beetles. And there's a bunch of different species within this group. Some of them can be much larger and more noticeable, things like if listeners are familiar with a larder beetle, which is from that group, and that one's almost up to a quarter inch or so long. But there are some species in that family that can be quite small, like an eighth of an inch or so, sometimes, give or take a little bit in terms of its size. So I would lean towards perhaps something from that family, the carpet beetle family at this point. The ultimate way to know would be if that caller still has some of them in their house, they could always collect some and then mail them into me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and then I can get them under the microscope when I have a chance. And that would be the definitive way to figure out exactly what they are. And once we know that, then we'd have a much better idea in terms of what those insects are doing in the house. Do they indicate some other issue, or are they just more of a temporary nuisance, perhaps?
Okay. So, Denise, if you have some more, please send them to PJ. And what's the best way to get that address, PJ?
So my mailing address, I'll repeat it twice for folks that are listening. It's 1630 Linden Drive, L-I-N-D-E-N, just like a linden tree, in Madison, Wisconsin. And the zip code is 53706. So again, that's 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. And you can either address it to me, PJ Leash, or if you address it to the Insect Diagnostic Lab or Insect Identification, it'll get to me in the mail. And if you ever send a sample in, just make sure to include a little note with like your email address or a phone number so I can get back in touch once the sample is submitted.
What's a good way to send that in? What should we put it in?
Oh, yes. That's a very important point. So one of the most important things, if you ever send in a physical sample, make sure to put it in some type of small, hard-bodied container. That could be a small Tupperware. Back when folks had film cameras, you know, the old black film canisters with the gray lids, those were great. Could be an empty pill bottle, small mason jar, anything like that. Package that up in a padded bubble wrap mailing envelope or a small box, and you can mail that in. If you simply put insects in an envelope or like tape them on a piece of paper, they usually end up pretty crushed by the time they get to me, and they may be unidentifiable.
Sure.
In that case.
Yeah, understandable. Okay, thank you, Denise. And let's go back to the phones, and Ron in Madison has a question. Hi, Ron.
Years ago, I left a brown recluse and my email address in a clean pill bottle for your predecessor, Dr. Phil Pilateri. He emailed me, asked where I got it. Dad's barn in southwest Missouri, 30 miles from Arkansas. Next story, as a preschooler, I learned to like the big black and yellow garden spiders with leg spans 3 to 4 inches wide. Mom explained that these spiders eat insects that eat our vegetables in the garden. And so if we leave those spiders alone and let them live, we'll have more vegetables to eat the summer, the fall, all the way through the winter. And then the third thing is about chiggers. Just last night, I told my sister, who still lives on that farm, one of the best things about living in Wisconsin is the chiggers don't live here yet. And so you have any idea how quickly the climate will allow them to survive up here? And I assume they can migrate, you know, if I go home and get a batch of them, they could migrate back with me in my dirty clothes and stuff.
Oh, great question, Ron.
Yeah, so a couple things to touch on in that call. So the brown recluse, that's interesting. You know, it had come from the part of the country, southwestern Missouri, where that's classic range form. So if you know the habitat to look in and you're in that part of the country, you can go out and find them. In terms of those big garden spiders, which I think are actually quite beautiful creatures, they're a type of orb weaver in the genus Argiope, and there's a couple different species we see out there. Some of them have stripes on the body. Some of them have more of a spots on their abdomen, for example. But they're beautiful creatures. Perhaps they're maybe a little bit intimidating in terms of their size, especially if someone isn't particularly fond of spiders. But all they do is they hang out in their web. They're going to be catching insects that come through. So they probably do help to a certain extent in the garden with like flying insect pests, because they create these large round orb webs, and flying insects that contact that have a decent chance of getting stuck and then preyed upon by the spiders. So they're just all around very, very cool spiders. In a given year at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, that's probably one of the commonest spiders that I see pictures coming into the lab of, is those large garden spiders, especially common in kind of mid to late summer onwards. And then the last thing to touch on would be chiggers. And you're absolutely right. In terms of chiggers, I very rarely see verified chigger cases in Wisconsin. They are here to a certain extent, but we just don't have very high populations of them compared to other parts of the country. For example, if you went just south of us a couple hundred miles or even all the way down towards the Gulf Coast, hotter climates they just seem to do much better in. In terms of climate change, that's a really good question. I'm not a climate expert, so I don't have any idea in terms of how quickly climate change would come about that would then create habitat conducive for chiggers. So that's a really good question. But again, we do have them around to a certain extent. But the good news for Wisconsinites is that chiggers tend to be pretty rare in the state, and also they tend to be quite isolated. when I think of chigger habitat, I tend to think of like sunny south-facing sides of hills with like bramble patches. That's a situation that if I wanted to go looking for chiggers, that might be where I went looking. But otherwise, if you're just out in the woods, we tend to very, very rarely encounter them.
Okay, let's hope it stays that way. Thanks for the question, Ron. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Lee Rayburn is our technical director today, and Dean Kinetter is our on-air producer. We are talking about spiders on the show today, but tomorrow we'll check in with financial advisor Frank Armstrong about what's going on with the stock market. That's tomorrow starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. Let's go back to the phones. We've got George in Ozaukee County who has a question for us. Hi, George.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd be interested in hearing your guest's opinion about camel spiders. I encountered several of them close up and personal when I was in Afghanistan. And the scariest one was I had a wire stand for my vanilla colored file folders and picked one up, and there was a camel spider sheltering underneath my files. Biggest one I saw was about, I think, maybe 6 to 8 inches long, and the feet were out about a foot. As I understand it, they're quite poisonous.
Oh, my. PJ?
Yeah, so camel spiders, they're a creature that we don't have here in Wisconsin. And even though they have the word spider in their name, they're not true spiders. Sometimes these same creatures are also called things such as wind scorpions. They're related to both spiders and scorpions in that they're a type of arachnid, meaning they've got 8 legs, but they're not true spiders, not true scorpions. So to really find those, you got to go to parts of the globe, they're a little bit drier, a little bit hotter. If you think about the U.S., we have records of them from some like the southwestern states, for example. You get down into Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, for example. We can bump into them down there. And in general, they are predators similar to spiders. So they do, attack prey that way. So certainly something that I wouldn't necessarily want to pick up with my bare hands.
Okay. Now, next we've got Yvonne in Spring Green. Hi, Yvonne.
Hello there.
Hi.
My question, if I can switch things over to deer ticks.
Sure.
I live in the country. I have an acre here. I have lawn all around, lots of flower beds, but I have weeds everywhere, and the little wild critters do run across my lawn. I know, don't see them. I know they come at night, and deer also. So I have lots of ticks. I get bit a couple of times the growing season and have to go in because I have a bullseye. I don't usually get the other symptoms, but I they're so tiny, it's hard to find them.
Yes.
My question is there going to be a vaccination? And what else can I do other than completely garbing totally and going outside in the hot sun to protect myself against these little critters?
Sure. So, good question. And ticks was something I was hoping would come up on the show today, just because with COVID-19, a lot of folks can't make it to the gym. So I've seen a lot of folks in my own neighborhood just going out for walks. And so it's a good time of the year to remind Wisconsinites that if there's no snow on the ground and it's above freezing, you can potentially bump into ticks. And the reason ticks are important are because of species like the deer tick that you mentioned. Because of medical concerns such as Lyme disease, deer ticks can also carry some other important diseases like anaplasmosis and babesiosis and even some viruses. But by far, the commonest disease we see with those in the state is Lyme disease. As the caller had mentioned, you can often get that bullseye rash, which, if my memory serves me correctly, about 3/4 of folks bitten by deer ticks, and if Lyme disease is transmitted, you tend to get that bullseye rash, but there's about 1/4 of the cases where it doesn't necessarily show up. So that can be an important indicator, but in terms of what you can do about it, because it's very difficult to just completely eradicate them from your yard, some of the things you can do would be like changing the habitat to a certain extent, maybe having the yard a little bit more open and drier and sunnier may make it a little bit more inhospitable for them, versus if your yard is simply deep woods with lots of trees and shrubs, it may be good habitat for the mammals that can play a role in this. In terms of things like a vaccine, there actually used to be a vaccine years ago. It hasn't been on the market for quite a while. I have heard rumblings on potentially a vaccine, some folks looking at it. I have not heard anything definitive on that in terms of if there's anything coming out for human use, which means that the most important thing for the time being would be to take individual precautions and protections. So some of the most important things would be long sleeves, and I know that can be difficult, especially if it's a, you know, if it's a hot 90 degree day, you don't necessarily want to have on long pants and long sleeve shirt. But what's nice about the long sleeves is they are a physical barrier preventing the ticks from getting to your skin. So I know a lot of folks, and I have colleagues that will wear pants and tuck the pants into the socks. That way, those ticks would have a very hard time getting to the skin. It can also be helpful to wear light colored clothing, which just makes it a little bit easier to spot those ticks. Some other things that you can do, using repellents like DEET and Picaridin are some of the top ones that I see sold at hardware stores and outdoor stores and things like that. There's a few other EPA registered repellents out there as well, but DEET seems to be kind of the gold standard that is very, very commonly used and can work well. A caution with the repellents, though, I always encourage folks to make sure to read the instructions on the repellent label. Sometimes it will say that the product should be applied to skin. Sometimes it might be a higher concentration product that says you should only apply it to clothing. So make sure to always follow those directions. The product label will also give you some guidance in terms of how long those repellents are expected to work to help repel things like ticks and mosquitoes. It may be a matter of 2 hours or 4 hours, sometimes even 6, 8, 10 hours, but you have to read the label and reapply it if needed. Also along the lines of repellents, you can buy some products out there that contain permethrin. And permethrin is spelled P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. Permethrin. And what's nice about permethrin, permethrin is technically a product, a compound that has insecticidal properties. And so you can purchase it as a clothing treatment. So you would get a little spray bottle that's often enough to treat a pair of boots, a pair of pants, a long sleeve shirt, for example. And that product can last through several washings. What's nice about the permethrin is it does have repellent properties. It can be long-lasting, and also it has insecticidal properties. It can actually kill the ticks if they touch it and contact it long enough. So that can be a very, very useful product to use, the permethrin products, especially if you have that favorite pair of gardening work pants and boots that you tend to put on when you're working outdoors. So that's another precaution. Lastly, I would mention, make sure to do tick checks. An important reason for that is a deer tick doesn't just bite you and give you Lyme disease. They actually have to be attached for a significant amount of time, and it's generally in the ballpark of about 36 to 48 hours or longer for Lyme disease to be transmitted. So with that said, if a tick bites you and 10 minutes later you remove it correctly, the chances of it transmitting Lyme to you are exceedingly low. So doing tick checks once you come in from doing outdoor work, or at least once a day, can be very, very helpful approaches, because again, if you are finding and removing those ticks within a short period of time, that can very greatly cut down the chances of Lyme transmission.
Okay, thank you for that call, Yvonne. Let's go to Dave in Rhinelander. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I moved up to Wisconsin from Ohio, and there was a real pale green spider that it was common in houses that was notorious for biting people. And it tended to hide in clothes or in sheets. And you wake up with a bite and swollen and itchy.
Okay. Do you are you aware of that one, PJ?
Well, what it reminds me of, there's a genus of spiders, sometimes called sac spiders, the genus Chirocanthium. And there's one we do see indoors, the yellow sac spider. And it's kind of a very faint yellowish, I could see perhaps a little bit of a hint of green in there as well. So that's my suspicion, is that it may be a spider from this genus Chirocanthium. Out of all the spiders out there, the vast majority really have no urge to bite you. That's a species that can be a little bit more, let's say, ornery, I guess. I have heard over the years of a bite here, a bite there. I don't get the impression that they're simply walking up to people and biting them. If you wake up out of bed and you see a red mark, it's always very difficult to tell, is that a spider or something else, especially if someone has multiple bites or suspected bites. That just tends to be inconsistent with spiders. So I do take that into consideration when I'm looking at cases like that. But we do have those yellow sac spiders around. Generally, in my opinion, they seem to be fairly benign. I've picked them up plenty of times in my own house and haven't had any issues with them.
Well, they just know that you like them, so they'll treat you better, PJ.
I guess so.
All right. Well, we're talking with PJ Leach. He is the manager of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. What insect questions do you have? We're taking your calls. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Jill Nadeau for The Larry Mueller Show. Do you have a question or comment about insects? Well, we'd like to hear from you today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. PJ Leach is back with us. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Have you seen an unusual bug? What questions do you have for PJ? Join this conversation by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We did get an email from Becky, PJ. She said that she has a regular spider resident in her mailbox. It's gray and fuzzy with some green around its mouth. And in the summer, hornets try to build nests in the mailbox, but not with this spider around.
Oh, what I wonder with the green color, and I'd love to know if the spider is fairly small, maybe about a quarter of an inch long or so. There's a very charismatic spider family, family Salticidae, or we commonly call them the jumping spiders, and some of them do have bright greens or reds or other colors. Those tend to be day-active spiders, and they're very agile, and they move around. They're a type of spider that doesn't really build a web for hunting. Instead, they move around and patrol. It turns out they're really cool spiders because they've got great color vision as well. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if someone had a local jumping spider or other spider in their mailbox, that may, to a certain extent, deter other insects from trying to set up shop there.
Okay, great. Let's go back to the phones now. Sue in Wausau has a question. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about moths.
Sure.
I will say that in the summertime, early summer, and then in early fall, we get moths in the house. They're probably, you know, I told your screener about an inch, but I took out my ruler, and I think they're closer to an inch and a half. And they're dark brown, and I say infestation because I absolutely cannot stand moths, and I know they can't hurt me, and my husband laughs at me, but we get them. I say I probably run across four or five of them a week up in the corners of my room in, you know, various parts of my house, and my husband said, well, you know, we keep the doors open, Sue, or we, you know, we windows or so forth, but I just truly believe that it almost is like they hatch somewhere in the house, or they might be coming down my chimney, but I mean, they're really pretty significant size.
Okay.
Well, first of all, interesting. It's got me scratching my head a little bit. And the reason I say that is when I think of indoor moths, I typically think of moths that are fairly small, like a quarter inch or less in size. So to find large moths indoors is definitely unusual. My main suspicion, because if you are a large moth, your juvenile stage, the larva or caterpillar, is going to have to be a really big insect. And those would be outdoors as plant feeders, and eventually those may turn into those large moths. So what I wonder in a case like this is that it may be an outdoor species associated with plants. And a couple possibilities that might be happening. One is that if the caterpillar stage is feeding on plants near the house, sometimes caterpillars, when they are done feeding, will wander and try to find a tucked away spot to go to that pupal stage. Because during the pupal stage, they're basically sitting ducks. They can be rather vulnerable to predators at that point. So they like to often do that in a tucked away, sheltered, secluded spot unless they had chemical protection or chemical defenses. So a possibility is that caterpillars might have been on plants, somehow snuck indoors through like a gap in a foundation or siding or something like that, turned to the adult moths and popped out indoors. So that's one possibility. What I think is more likely is that these may be adult moths from outside, so they completed their life cycle outdoors. Some adult moths, for example, will hide during the day, and they may get beneath siding or otherwise into the house, and then they may kind of take a wrong turn and end up indoors. To know the exact answer, what I would do in this case is if you see those moths next time, snap a couple of pictures, or if possible, grab one of the moths. And if you can get those images to me here in Madison at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, if you hop online and do a Google search for UW Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, you should be able to find my website. And I've got instructions on there in terms of how to email photos to me. And if we can figure out the exact species of moth, then we'll have a much better idea of what they're up to, where they're coming from, and so on. In the meantime, because I suspect that it's a type of moth probably sneaking in from outdoors, I would maybe take a close look at the exterior of your home and just see if you look at your siding, for example, if there's gaps where they might be sneaking under the siding and getting in or around window or door frames. If we're able to seal that up and physically have a barrier there, that may prevent them from getting in. So that's something you could do in the meantime.
Okay, Sue, looks like your husband's right this time. This time. Thank you for the question. Let's go to Louise in Dodgeville next. Hi, Louise.
Hi, good morning, or actually good afternoon. I have a question about our honeybees. We live in the country. We have an open compost in like a wire container. And yesterday when I took a trip out, and I noticed last summer as well, our bees, and I know it kind of sounds crazy. I know there are bees. They look kind of different than the wild bees around here. But they love being in our compost pile. So I was wondering what it is that they are sourcing from the compost.
Ah, good question. And it's not uncommon or unheard of to see that phenomenon this time of the year, because at this point, we really don't have flowers up to serve as a nectar source. So if it's a warm enough day that the bees are active and they're heading out, they may be looking to forage something. I have had similar cases in the past of them going to compost piles where maybe there's a source that has some nutritional value, some sugars, for example, or possibly a moisture source. So I've had reports of them, for example, going to a compost pile, scavenging amongst parts of oranges and coffee grounds and stuff like that. So I suspect they're simply going there to either get food or water, because that may be the only thing available this time of the year.
Okay, thank you very much, Louise. Next up is Jim, and he's in Waukesha County. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon. Good show as usual.
Thank you.
I have a magnolia tree that's retained about 20 curled brown leaves all winter. I never thought a whole lot about it, but I thought it was odd that just those few leaves would be still remaining on the tree. And so yesterday when I was out poking around, I kind of grabbed one of them, and it was really stuck on the limb yet. And I felt that there seems to be a cocoon inside this curled brown leaf. That's maybe about an inch and a half long by about a half inch wide. Any thoughts, ideas what that is? I didn't take it apart. I left it on a tree, cause not knowing what it was.
Sure.
And all the leaves that have that are still on the tree all have that same cocoon-like thing in there. Any thoughts?
Interesting. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if there were some type of Lepidoptera, that is a moth perhaps, that is using that as an overwintering site for the cocoons. There are a number of caterpillars, for example, that will take leaves and basically tie it together with silk and kind of make a shelter so that when they do pupate, they're more protected. So I wonder if something like that is going on. In terms of species associated with magnolias, when I think of magnolias and insects, magnolia scale comes to mind. There's a few other things. I can't think of any magnolia-specific caterpillars off the top of my head. There may be some, but I'd encourage you to shoot me an email on that topic, and if you're able to include a couple of photos, that may help me narrow it down, and we may be able to figure out exactly what species it is from that information.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. And let's go now to Peter in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Hi. I'm enjoying the show. Thank you very much. This is a more general question about the value of commercial pest control companies like Terminix and Orkin, et cetera. Maybe 15 years ago, we had a millipede sort of invasion. Nothing really serious since then, but about them, we started this service. They come around the house once a year and spray. Used to be a couple times a year, sometimes inside. They used to be, but it's not now. And I thought I'd ask an expert here. Phil isn't there anymore, but I got you, so I'm asking you.
Sure. I mean, when it comes to pest control companies, there's a lot of good ones out there. What I like to ask folks to do is kind of take a step back and look at the bigger picture. And you kind of have to ask yourself, what are you trying to accomplish with a pest control company? And you need to have good communication with the company as well. There's a lot of insects, for example, that like to sneak indoors, especially in late summer and early fall. Things like box elder bugs, cluster flies, Asian lady beetles, brown marmorated stink bugs, and things like that. And if a home or a structure has a history of those, then that may be a situation where spraying just once at that time of the year can make sense if you're not able to seal up all the openings that they're getting through. If you don't seem to have any pest issues at all, you know, then you could perhaps consider cutting back on spraying, for example. There's other cases, though, where I would say having a pest control company come out is really an invaluable route to go, because there are certain pests such as bed bugs where if you try to do it yourself, you can just make the situation a lot worse. So my general thought is you kind of have to go on a case-by-case basis and see, you know, what's the pest you're dealing with and what are you trying to achieve. And there are definitely cases where you can do it yourself, and then there's other cases where you definitely need to call in some professionals to take care of the issue.
Okay, thank you, Peter, for that question. PJ, do we have to be concerned about whatever they're spraying that's going to kill the good insects also?
Well, yeah, and I get a lot of questions about that. It would depend on, you know, what they're trying to control with their particular products. The commonest group of insecticides that pest control companies use, it's a class we call the pyrethroids. These are products such as permethrin, which I mentioned earlier. You can actually apply to clothing for tick control and tick repellency. There's a whole bunch of other molecules in that group. These are synthetic versions of some natural products coming from chrysanthemums that happen to have insecticidal properties. These products typically don't last terribly long. They do have a broad spectrum of activity, meaning that if you were to take the same products and apply them to, say, a flower patch, which we would never want to do, you know, that can pose risks to bees and other things in that area. But again, you have to look at where they're applying these things. If they're applying these products just along the edge of your foundation, around window and door frames, you know, there's not really bees going to, you know, the base of your foundation necessarily, or around window and door frames. And so if they're applying it to spots where beneficial insects are not likely to bump into it, we can minimize the risks that they're going to face.
Okay, good information there. So PJ, Are you able to get to your email, PJ is from...
I am, yes.
Okay, could you open it up? PJ is calling in. Obviously, we're trying to keep social distance here at WPR, too. But we got a picture and from Joey, and he was wondering about a couple of spiders. One they call the Ritz cracker, which lives in a raspberry patch. It has black and white legs and a big round back that looks like a cracker. Did you get that one?
Yes, I did get an email with a couple photos on it of spiders. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the large one, black and yellow with the spots on it?
Nope, because apparently someone else, there's an orb spider that lives. Oh, that's he sent two of them. And that one is an orb spider. And then the other one is the one that looks like a Ritz cracker.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at that. Yeah, so this is a good-sized spider.
Okay.
It's got a big, plump abdomen, kind of beige in color with some white spots on there. And this is also from the orb weaver family. This particular species looks like it's the shamrock orb weaver because it's got the kind of these four whitish spots on the abdomen, like a four-leaf clover makes me think of shamrock. These can be very common, and there's a couple very close relatives. These are common, especially in kind of mid-summer onwards. It's a group of spiders that basically completes their adult stage late in the year. So I see a lot of these in August, September, and October, and usually by the time we get to trick-or-treating or so, they're basically done for the year. But these can be very common. They're harmless, they're big, they're beautiful, and they're beneficial because they're eating insects that are, in this case, around that raspberry patch, but common throughout yards and gardens.
Okay, great. Thanks for checking those out, PJ. Let's go back to the phones now. Judy in Racine has a question. Hi, this is Judy.
Hi. I wonder if centipedes bite and do they serve any useful purpose?
Centipedes. So centipedes, in my mind, in terms of the role they play in the world around us, it's going to be very similar to spiders. Centipedes are predators. They do have venom glands and fangs, for example. If you ask a lot of folks, they tend to have kind of a negative view of centipedes as well because they tend to scurry away from us very, very quickly. If you see them in your house, again, the role they play is going to be very similar to spiders. So if you have a lot of centipedes around, it tells me there must be insects or other prey that they're feeding on. In theory, if you were to pick them up, could they bite you defensively? They probably could. It's not going to make your finger fall off or anything like that. But, it's probably going to get your attention like a mild bee sting, I would imagine. Centipedes, we've got a couple species that can be fairly common indoors. They play a role very, very similar to spiders, though. So they are beneficial in that regard. But because they run around so quickly, it really leaves kind of a negative impression in a lot of folks' minds.
Okay, thank you very much for that question. Centipedes kind of creep people out, too. I mean, they've got a lot of legs.
They do, yeah. And as I mentioned, I think it's the fact that they scurry so quickly. Centipedes are those creatures that you flick on the light at night, you're getting a drink of water in the kitchen or something like that, and you see one running really quickly across the floor. Sometimes they do end up in sinks. Folks get the impression that they're coming up through the drains, which I really don't think is happening at all. What I suspect happens is they fall into a sink, and then because of the curvature of the base of the sink, they just can't crawl back out because of the slippery nature.
Okay. Well, that makes sense because I don't think they could survive in the drain.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the call, Judy. And let's go to Pete in Racine. Hi, Pete.
Hello. Yes, I think the reason for the spider mites that the bees are suffering from is all the bat poop that's for sale in gardening centers and hardware stores and such. And I've seen nature programs about bats and bat caves. And there's a rising mass of weird life form, as well as all sorts of insects and centipedes, millipedes, spiders, cockroaches, anything.
Okay. All right, PJ, is guano causing problems?
To the best of my knowledge, I have not heard of any connections between guano and bees, such as honeybees. The caller did mention mites. There are certain mites that can cause major problems for bees, such as the varroa mite, for example, which is kind of like a dog tick on bees, if you think about it. They're an external or ectoparasite and can cause issues, and they can also transmit viruses within a hive. If you look at any animal, though, be it a bat or even insects, there's a lot of other life that lives on it. A bat guano, you know, I'm sure there's a certain set of creatures that can live amongst that. There are insects and other mites that live on the surface of other insects, sometimes just hitching a ride, sometimes as parasites. But you take a closer look, and there's a lot of interconnectedness between life forms out there.
Yes, there are. Next up, we have Rana in Cameron. Hi, Rana.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. So my call is about one of the insecticides that your guest has been talking about, permethrin, spelled P-E-R. And as a kid on a dairy farm, I remember my uncle spraying fly spray that had an ingredient in it that I thought was spelled P-Y-R, and the purpose of it was to keep the flies down in the barn while milking. Eventually, the particular permethrin I'm talking about, I believe, was removed from materials because it was carcinogen, and maybe I'm all messed up, but I'm wondering if the P-E-R is any relation to the P-Y-R permethrin, and thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
Sure. So what I suspect in this case is that the fly spray probably contained pyrethrins. Pyrethrins is basically a kind of a mixture of different naturally occurring compounds. They come from certain types of chrysanthemum flowers. And these ingredients naturally have insecticidal properties and they can work very quickly. I'm not aware of any carcinogenic properties. These are very, very widely used. You can still get pyrethrins today. And in fact, if someone is an organic gardener, for example, they can still use pyrethrins for insect control in organic settings because it's naturally derived. A limitation of the pyrethrins, though, is that this natural extract tends to break down very, very quickly in sunlight within like 24 hours, give or take. And as a result, if you are a farmer, if you want to use this for pest control and spray for flies or your field or whatnot, you almost have to spray every day, and then that can increase the chances of having negative impacts on beneficials flying by, that sort of thing. What chemists did, though, is they took these natural pyrethrins and they tweaked the molecules. They made them more photostable, and they've been doing this for a couple of decades now. And as a result, we've gotten permethrin, and there's a long list of other ones like bifenthrin, cypermethrin, cyfluthrin, lambda-cyhalothrin, S-phenvalerate, and so on. And these are very widely used. And these newer products, they work the same way as the natural extract against insect nerves, but they last longer, maybe about a week or two if they're sprayed outdoors before they break down in sunlight, for example.
Great. Thanks for that question, Rana. Appreciate it. Next is Elizabeth in Platteville. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good
afternoon.
Good morning,
afternoon.
Good afternoon. I better look at the clock. I was calling. This is a little bit later in the program now. I tried to get on before, but I couldn't. Years ago, my husband was bitten by a brown recluse. He developed a red spot on his leg just above his knee, and it was very angry red. And so he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, it's a good thing you came, because I'm sure that was a brown recluse. And he drew a ring on his leg, and he said, if it goes spreads outside that, you call me immediately. Well, it didn't spread outside of that ring, but it stayed there a long time, probably a couple of weeks at least. Finally, it started to recede, and the doctor said when it has receded, you will be able to see a bullseye in where you had gotten bitten. And sure enough, when it finally receded enough, there was the little bullseye. And that stayed on his leg for years afterwards, that you could see that little spot. And he said the reason that he was pretty sure it was a brown recluse was that they had been moving north because of our warmer winters, and that he had been working with wood, and that's where they would hide. And it had...
Okay, well, yeah.
The wood.
Thanks, Elizabeth. PJ, have you heard anything about them moving north?
I have not. And this is an interesting topic, and we're running towards the end of the show, so I won't be able to get into it a whole lot. It turns out there is an arachnologist in California named Rick Vetter, and he went on a crusade for about 20 or so years trying to dispel a lot of myths about the brown recluse spider. It turned out medical doctors were kind of notorious for a while for overdiagnosing skin lesions as brown recluse bites. And it turns out there's a long list of medical explanations where you can get kind of an ulcerating wound as a possibility. What it turned out is that Rick Vetter teamed up with medical doctors, and they figured that a lot of these so-called bites were probably bacterial infections. Some other clues that play into that, if we look at a place like Wisconsin, we're outside the native range, could they eventually creep northwards with warmer temperatures? It's a possibility, but we just have not seen that yet. So overall, they're exceedingly rare in the state. Also, it turns out when arachnologists really studied these spiders, turns out they really don't want to bite you at all. There is a paper that came out, looked at a family, I believe in Kansas, where they had thousands of these spiders over the course of multiple years, and no one in the household was ever bitten by them. So up here, they're rare. They really don't like to bite. And then it turns out that for verified bites, about 90% of the bites, you just get a little localized reaction. Only about 10% of confirmed brown recluse bites lead to a necrotic type wound. So when you start looking at all these odds for things, the odds of having a necrotic wound from brown recluse spider bites in Wisconsin is exceedingly rare.
So is there something that they actually should look for? I mean, should they go to the doctor? Should they just wait and see? I mean, I know you're not a medical expert, but what would you suggest?
I mean, my general advice, if you have something that looks like a concern, would be simply to head into the doctor and chat about it. Because as I mentioned, there can be quite a few other things documented in the medical literature where you can get wounds that can be blamed on spider bites sometimes, but they have other causes.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for talking with us, PJ. We appreciate you calling in from your office today.
Sure.
Okay, we've been talking with PJ Leach. He's the manager of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And you have been listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry this week. On the show tomorrow, we'll talk about the stock market with financial advisor Frank Armstrong. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network.